Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by BlackRifleCoffee.com. Put down the water and grab a fucking drink.
Welcome to Drinking Bros. Hope everybody is having a great Memorial Day weekend out there. Hope everybody's being safe. We got a great show tonight. Evan Hafer is actually a gigantic stand-up comedy fan. We had a guy on the show named John Stites, who was a comedian, and him and Evan hit it off really, really well. And he was just like, man, I'd love to have the guy back on and chat with him personally. And we're like, dude, absolutely, full send. So this is part two of our John Stites interview, and this is with Evan Hafer. And we're super stoked about that, almost as stoked about that as we are Matt Best book release. Thank You for My Service is now on presale on Amazon. Go out and get it. The hardbacks is what matter. That's what'll get us on the New York Times bestseller list. Check it out. Go to Amazon and buy the book. It's fucking hilarious. This is a long 3 years and it's finally about to come out. So we're amped. Please go out and pre-order a copy of Thank You for My Service. And as always, we got some sponsors who pay for this whole shit wagon to be on the air. First and foremost, you know them, you love them. Talking about BlackRifleCoffee.com. Black Rifle Coffee is a premium roast-to-order coffee made with the hands of veterans and then shipped out straight to you. You can get it in K-cups, bags, whole beans, grounded beans, you name it, they got it. Sign up for their Coffee Club of the Month program. Look, I've had it for years, man. I love it. BlackRifleCoffee.com is the best coffee in the biz, and it's actually the number one e-commerce coffee company in the world currently. Type in the promo code DRINKINBROS20 for 20% off at BlackRifleCoffee.com. Next up, we've got BoxOfAwesome.com. Yeah! Man, we've been using the shit out of these guys. We travel with them. Man, you go to their sites. It's boxofawesome.com. And each month, as a dude, if you actually give a shit about your appearance and what your apartment looks like or your house or whatever, this is cool shit for dudes, man. I got a dop kit from there. I got a travel bag from there. I got fucking shakers. I got stirrers. You name it. Bar equipment. Just cool shit for dudes, man. And it's a surprise box, $50 a month. Boom. Shows up to your house. And it's something practical, something that'll make, again, your house look great or you look great as a person when you're out on the road traveling. Love boxofawesome.com. Use the promo code DRINKINBROS for 20% off your first box at boxofawesome.com. Love these guys, man. I love that travel bag. I use that fucking thing everywhere, man. So super stoked that they are on the show. Next up, we've got ExpressVPN.com. ExpressVPN.com is back, /drinking bros. Love ExpressVPN.com /drinking bros. Why? Because they protect all my shit. Dude, cyber attacks are real, man. People are getting your shit. Dan Holloway talks about this company all the time. It's one of his faves. I didn't know much about that type of shit, man. I just figured, hey, man, I'm like everybody else. Like, my passwords get jacked. I got to change my shit or whatever. No big deal. Turns out, if you have an app running in the background of your computer, your tablet, your iPhone, no matter what, then your shit won't get hacked. I didn't know this. Sign up for this company when they were a sponsor last year, and then they're back this year. ExpressVPN.com /drinking bros. $7 a month. Runs in the back of your computer. You don't have to worry about people hacking in your bank account or Amazon or any of that other shit. I love these guys. I use them. When I didn't use them and I got a new computer, I got my shit jacked, dude. Somebody tried to buy something off of Amazon from me. Crazy, man. Anyways, go to expressvpn.com /drinking bros today and get on it. 3 free months for free, and it's only $7 a month. So, you know, $7 a month, protect all of your computer equipment. It's worth it, dude. And 3 free months at expressvpn.com/drinkingbros. Lastly, we got buyraycon.com. That's buyraycon.com. BUYRAYCON.com. These are the headphones we're all using now, man. Love these things. Again, we try to get a fucking deal with iTunes, and they said no. They said no with the Beats by Dr. Dre. Beats by Dr. Dre said no. We reached out to some other headphone companies because, look, we're always wearing them in the gym and workout. Dude, Snoop Dogg's company, I think he runs it with Ray J. Him and, like, all these guys are like, look, man, these are dope. These are affordable. They're $70, but with the promo code Drinking Bros, you get 20% off there. And I think if you just go to this link directly, buyraycon.com/drinkingbros, boom, you automatically get the 20% off. So I don't think you'd have to type anything when you get out of there. But everybody's wearing these things, and it was like, oh, shit, this is what these were. Like, I've seen people wear these everywhere. Now they're a sponsor on the show. Super stoked, because we all use headphones, obviously, in podcasting and every part of our day. But we all go to the gym and shit, too, and run. These are, they just kind of just fit right in your ear. It's great. And they don't look like the cum shot fucking iPhone things, man. I hate those goddamn headphones. So now, buyraycon.com/drinkingbros is on the show with us. These are cheap, affordable, fucking amazing headphones that you can sweat through. These things will last you through fucking wars, man. Big fans of these guys. Thanks for coming on the show, and thanks for reaching out after we try to do the Dr. Dre thing. We appreciate it. So go to buyraycon.com/drinkingbros. These things are awesome, man, and everybody's wearing these. Now let's hop into the show, shall we?
You know what we decided to do?
This is round two.
Yeah, this is round two. You know
why?
It was
too good for one. Hey,
we didn't want to stop. I didn't want to stop.
I didn't either, dude.
Man, I didn't want to stop either. I was like, what the fuck?
That was like,
because we didn't even get into some a couple things, like, let alone the rest of what's going to unfold here.
We have some topics that we want to cover, because when we left, like right after we left, we got into
Operation Comedy,
because it was like, hey, man, we didn't even get into this. What the fuck, man? So
yeah.
Tell us what the hell is going on over there.
10 years ago, I was a national sales manager for a healthcare IT company, making a lot of money, but wanted to put a bullet in my head.
A lot of people, I think, suffer from that.
Oh, dude.
You know?
And it was great in as much as it was 2008 and the crash happened and I was one of those victims, man. We just woke up one day, no job, just everything gone. And I was like, well, the advantage of that is from the rubble, you can just go, what have I always wanted to do? And the USO, I went down to see a USO show at Camp Atterbury in southern Indiana with a friend of mine that's a vet. And they were like, you can't come in. And I was like, but I'm a vet. And they said, well, we're only active duty and retirees. And I didn't know that. And I thought, well, no shit. I don't think, and no one I've talked to knows that. So I thought, well, there's 30 million right. vets and we're a bunch of savages and we're getting no real comedy. I said, well, that's what I'm going to do is, and I didn't create a great idea. I just took an existing one, but made it R-rated, provided a lot of alcohol and took the USO experience. And I thought gave vets what they really wanted, which is the Bill Burrs and the Ron Whites
exactly
and the Jim Jefferies
really
and the guys who, you know, really
tell you what they get. They get the fucking D crew.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and that's why nobody really wanted. Military gigs are fucking some of the worst, man. They weren't that attractive anymore because the risk reward to your brand, if you're a big star, is skewed heavily with risk. If you say something wrong, if you say the wrong thing.
Well, travel's brutal, number one.
Yep.
They don't accommodate you. You know, they're not going to pamper you, which everybody gets. Nobody ever goes into a USO or AFE tour like
totally.
I'm expecting first class or anything. You know it's going to be brutal. But just give me my time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and if you can't do that, if you want them to go for $120 a day, guys like these guys, for $120 a day in coach flying from here to Kuwait and then Kuwait on a military aircraft into Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Africa – and then you're going to tell them, hey, you're going to need to make this, you know, radio good or whatever. It's kind of like,
or will they can't
the fuck is wrong,
or they just can't even give them any because nobody knows what's off limits anymore. And now with cell phones and everything, it's just, you know, the risk of it. And to the military's credit, you know, they, you know, the other thing about comedy is, unlike music, when comedy's bad and amateur, it's fucking the worst.
Can't even listen to it.
Can't listen to it. Got to turn away. It's like, it's, you think you the office makes you, yeah, you get embarrassed.
So you want to leave.
Yeah, you feel horrible.
Like, it's not
for
even
that
like
person.
Oh, this is a bad song. It's like, ooh,
and
this
unlike,
is
you know,
unfolding.
If a band's bombing with their new shit, they can jump into covers. That doesn't happen in comedy. So the military had also been scarred by every asshole local comic who goes to a base and just gets up and, you know, fuck. So what I also found was the military really wanted to cooperate with me. They were thrilled that somebody was going to take it off base because that took all the risk out of their hands.
Got it.
So the PAOs loved it. They were like, this is fucking great, man, because we want to support you and we want to give the troops some good entertainment. But, you know, we can't risk that. And I totally got it, man. And that was sort of the genesis for it, man. And it just, I mean, to be perfectly frank, the first show I ever did, it's not that hard. I was in sales and marketing forever. I got Bob and Tom is a very popular radio station in Indianapolis. I got their support. And I just went to a 2,000-seat theater and said, how much is it to rent it? And they said, it's $5,000. I'm like, well, I'll give you $800 in cash. And, of course, they said yes. And I gave away 10,000 tickets and got some corporate sponsors. And the first show I ever did was a 2,000-seater, completely sold it out. And if I was like, well, if I can do this in the Midwest, I can fucking do this anywhere. Then I started picking up big corporate sponsors like Old National Bank and Humana. The problem was, just like the military, comedy is highly, highly toxic for, you know, risk-averse corporations.
Yeah.
So it just got to the point where even Humana, which is run by, like, the Humana military, they've got the TRICARE contract. There are some they're vets, and they were still like, man, we love you, but... And I was like, I get it.
How is this turned into this, though? We're just letting people go.
Yep.
This was the next conversation that we had, which we wanted to dive into.
Volunteer.
Absolutely.
You're volunteering to go watch something, and all of a sudden, it's a risk. It's a risk.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What the fuck?
Yeah. And it's a huge fucking thing, man. And there's, you know, we had something recently. Ross and I were talking about the Louis C.K. thing. Like, that was one, that, you know, it was one thing to see regular assholes and social justice warriors turn on him. But then other comics started, specifically Judd Apatow.
Judd Apatow.
I will say this. He did a couple Operation Comedy shows. He was a nice guy. I never had any problem with him whatsoever.
He's super anti-gun. Super.
And it's not even that. I don't even, man, my thing is First Amendment. Everything, there's a reason that motherfucker's number one. I mean, I like guns, I like this, I like that, but the First Amendment is the one. There's no discussion for me. There's a reason the Westboro Baptist assholes are allowed to do what they do, is because the fucking First Amendment is off fucking limits. People can say what they fucking want to say, like it or not.
You know, that's funny that you bring that up now, is we haven't really seen much of the Westboro Baptist Church in about 4 or 5 years. Could you imagine if they rolled out now, the meltdown?
I mean, they've been around a little bit, but not as much.
Yeah, they went quiet. They went pretty quiet.
I think the media is actively avoiding showing anything they do, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's how we deaden it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although it would play into the narrative that everybody's divided out there. There's like 400 assholes at this church.
Yeah.
But
that's the whole thing. They're taking 400 guys.
Yep.
Just like this whole white supremacist bullshit where they're like, there's all these fucking white supremacists. Yeah. Like, man, there's like 5,000 people in the United States. Like, most of the dudes that we know, like, and we used race as a means of comedy, and everybody was in that. It wasn't a means of, like, it wasn't humiliating anybody. It was like, the dude on your team is a dude on your team. He fucking beat your ass one day at something. Yep. And you beat his ass the next day, but nobody was like, oh man, you're inferior. It's like, no, dude, nobody believed any of that bullshit.
No.
People were making fun of stereotypes and using stereotypes and emphasizing that as a means of comedy.
As a means to escape a shitty situation.
Yeah.
It's only funny because it's not true.
And it's not true.
If you call your buddy an asshole, you're not saying it because you actually think he's a piece of shit human being, I hope. Otherwise, you're a fucking idiot for having a friend like that. Right. But it's the same concept. That's what.
But the up what was refreshing was to finally see something where, because you know there's certain things where comics, they don't want to stand up to it. They, you know, they don't want the blowback. They don't want to deal with it, whatever. But finally, with this Apatow thing, where he started ripping Louis C.K. based on the type of joke he told, and all the comics
Which one
were
was
just
it?
Like, where it was like, "How dare you?" I mean, he went on Jim Norton. If you want to see, if you want to see, and if you're listening to this and you hate these motherfuckers who want to police the First Amendment, go watch on YouTube Jim Norton's episode where Judd Apatow thinks he's going to get some softball questions launched his way.
From Jim Norton?
Jim Norton is a fucking stand-up comic, Boston, yeah. Bill Burr, Joe Rogan from right. that school. He ripped him to shreds. He's Didn't like, wait a minute, what are you
fuck,
doing
really?
Policing what he's allowed to say? And Judd just dug in his heels and was like, well, you know, I've known Parkland survivors. And fucking Norton goes, I've known 25 of my friends who've killed themselves. You think I just don't do suicide jokes? Like, right. what the fuck are you talking about? And it was good to see finally the
God.
Wagons get circled and go,
I don't know.
Look, this is the one thing, you guys, that we can't have people doing. I mean, Canada, which everyone here refers to as, you know, you Elysian Fields, and it's the greatest thing ever. They're bringing comics before their version of The Hague, before fucking human rights courts.
If you offend right. somebody,
if you
you're
fucking
getting
offend,
in trouble.
Yeah, motherfuckers aren't going to tell jokes in Canada anymore. They were like, fuck that shit. Fuck that, man. It's that's what I find more horrifying than anything is the attack on the First Amendment and what people say. That's really what freaks me to fuck out. You want to have a discussion about guns or climate change, or we can have a nuanced discussion, but the First Amendment, man, that shit's off limits for comics. That's all the fuck we got. Like, there's only two, like, that's it.
Well, it's commentary, right? It's commentary about what's going on in society. And so when you're limiting and forcing people to think about a situation and forcing them, and when I say forcing them, you're forcing them to think outside of their box.
Yes.
And that's really tough for people to do. Paradigms are really difficult for people to fucking, like, shift. They can't, actually.
Mm-mm.
I would say most people can't do that.
No.
So when they're locked into a narrative, they're locked into some type of social justice narrative where they're like, oh my God, anything out of this script is going to be, I'm going to go after this. That's what I have to do. They're actually programmed to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and when you condition yourself like that, you also, you start seeing those things, maybe even in places where they aren't. Like
yeah.
how constellations, that's just the human imagination.
Yeah.
Like, this is basically that shape. Oh, that's a fucking lion in the sky, bro. No, it's just our brains want to find patterns. And when you condition yourself like that, to have that kind of mindset where you're in a victim mentality all the time, that you're going to find it everywhere you fucking
go. Well,
and
you know, the left.
It's life. Life is abrasive, man.
The left and liberals or whatever term you want to use, you know, they used to be the defenders of artistic freedom because they had all the artists. They were the ones going,
yeah.
you're allowed to have a rape scene in a movie. You're allowed to have tits on a statue. We don't have to cover up Michelangelo's dick. They used for throughout
that's
the millennia.
What's crazy
that's
about
what's
it,
fucking crazy.
We've completely,
completely
flipped.
Completely flipped.
We're seeing it though. This is fucking incredible.
Yes.
We're seeing a shift. We're seeing a shift from where we were 10 years ago, where the liberal and or progressive and or Democratic Party was, and then you're shifting it, and you're like, I think that the majority of the people are actually what we would call the common sense middle. It's like,
yes.
we don't want to see this go down. And you've got these guys on the right, and really, I only look at political parties as far as more control and less control. I don't actually differentiate between Democrat or Republican.
I don't look at it
and I say, you want more control or you want less control? And then what types of controls do you want? That's really what I'm looking at. I'm not looking at anything other. So when you've got alt-right or alt-left, however you want to fucking program this, or left or right or however we want to articulate it, it's really about control. It's who is in control and what are they trying to control?
Absolutely. And I think at my core, Mike, I think also, man, and I'm no genius, but I truly believe this in my heart of hearts, is most of these warriors, these people that get behind these causes, they don't even really give a fuck. Like, it's one thing, like, okay, if a sexual assault survivor gets behind that, I'm 100% on board with that, 100%. But a lot of these people, and I'm not just, you know, singling that out, but whether it's cancer or whatever, they just want to feel some applause.
Right.
Their life is shit like every other lemming, as you use. I love that analogy. What they want to hear is someone go, yes, me too. And then people love to go, but they're not honestly, even really that offended,
honestly,
man.
Honestly, break this down a little bit more, and let's look at like late 90s. Like, what was the left attacking? Music and video games.
Yeah.
The Clintons were fucking after Eminem and rap music.
Well, it's Gore, Al Gore's wife.
Yeah, but right. Come on, the right was too. I mean, when George,
everybody was after,
everyone was.
But we were blaming. We were placing
blame.
Let's even
go back.
True.
Though, yeah. Two Live Crew.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
There you're going back.
Two Live Crew was fucking like they were literally brought out and fucking put on a. You know, they're getting ready to fucking tar and feather these dudes.
Eazy-E, yeah, like N.W.A., Ice-T,
yes, N.W.A.
When Ice-T did Cop Killer,
yeah.
And George H.W. Bush, yeah. The fucking president of the United States, and Ice-T said in an interview years later, he was like, man, when the president of the United, I'm like, gangster, whatever, when the president of the United States puts your name in his mouth, that's bad fucking news, right. Man. That's some scary shit. And I was like, yeah, dude.
It was a blame placer. Like, it's how can we shift the tension, give a cause for everybody to fucking chatter about,
yeah.
And blame, but now we're seeing it again. It's a carbon copy of the same tactic.
But yeah. I think a lot of us grew up in that generation, too, where I grew up, I went to a Two Live Crew concert in the middle of fucking Idaho, nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that I turned out.
Because there was nothing
well.
Like that before for us.
No.
It's almost like when we were talking about, you know, Hendrix versus Stevie Ray Vaughan. I mean, you can listen to, you know, Eminem or whoever now, and we're numb to it. But when Two Live Crew came out, they were fucking insane. They were Jerry Curls and fucking bitches and fuck this and fuck that and nut. And their live shows in the heartland would shut shit down.
Yeah.
Right? That was amazing. And we'd never seen nothing like that.
Never. And honestly, there was an element to this, like just rap in general, right? There's an element to it that was racist. And it was like, hey, we don't want anything that comes out of this section of the music industry to even be aired on the radio.
The only one that was for it was Jimmy Iovine, and look where he's at.
Absolutely, dude. Have you watched?
And they don't realize. This is the dude
exactly.
That Bruce Springsteen.
Him and Rick Rubin. Him and Rick Rubin. Absolutely, two fucking white Jews. Absolutely from New York. Absolutely.
You know, he made Bruce Springsteen. He did Fleetwood Mac. He did.
Have you watched the HBO documentary?
Oh my God, yes.
Blew
have you seen
my no, fucking mind, dude.
This guy is the greatest story of just
ever.
Yeah, he's 19 years old, sweeping floors in a music studio in New York. He's a young, skinny Jewish kid. Like, his dad made him get a job. He goes into this studio and is just there to fucking sweep the floors. But the owner of the studio is like super into like teaching anybody that will listen about how to do this shit.
Yeah.
So he teaches Jimmy every day for the first like what, two or three months?
Yep.
Like of just here's how to work the board, here's how to do everything. You know, this is how you engineer a track. He'd pull him in and be like, I want you to watch me produce this guy. And he was like, just watch what I'm telling him to fix and do and everything like that. And this 19-year-old kid is just recording all this, like carbon copy. And then this day comes where he gets, the owner of the studio gets like, what, strep throat or something? He's like,
no, it was the lead engineer got
yeah,
sick.
He got
and,
sick.
And if you're, and if
and
you're
out.
Young and you're listening to this, this is the story of fucking life. Be ready.
For America.
And, absolutely. And what
and
happened?
And the owner came in and he's
yep.
like, hey,
you engineer?
Jimmy. I need you to run the board for this new guy coming in here that's going to cut a record. So Jimmy runs a board for a whole week while this guy's sick.
Kills it.
And produces. Like, he copies everything he saw this guy do as just seeing, like, hey, maybe retake this, do this way. He's just doing exactly what he saw. And that dude that came in was Bruce Springsteen. That was his first album.
Born to fucking
shit.
Run, dude.
So
Born to Run.
Gets released. Goes number one, buttfuck wild, and the first phone call comes back in from Fleetwood Mac. She goes, the only person I want to work with is the one that was on Bruce's album.
And then you know what
so
he
this
says?
This is number two.
And what he has to put it on hold because he says, I'm sorry, I'm working with this dude named Tom Petty. and he's the one, and Jimmy Iovine was the brainchild. This documentary shows it all. Damn the Torpedoes, which blew Tom Petty into the stratosphere. Refugee, The Waiting, all those songs, Jimmy Iovine.
So, fast forward, Jimmy Iovine creates Interscope Records.
Yeah.
This is his.
Oh, my like, God. This is fucking incredible.
And NWA comes in, and he's like, you know what? Something's here.
Something's here.
And but he tells, who is it, Dre or T? He tells him, I think you guys need to start. When is it when he tells him, you know, to start your own Death Row or everything like
oh,
that?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Like, well, right off the after about 10 minutes of hanging out, where there was Dre, Eazy-E, and Ice Cube,
and you had Suge Knight, and it was
Suge Knight, and idiots, and scary dudes with MAC-10s, and he's like, "Listen, yeah, about the guys who actually think this is real, that's not going to make any money. It's going to get us all killed. Get rid of fucking
guys,
those dudes,
yeah, and just rid of those to, like, guys. Do this fucking music." Yep. So we're gonna fucking do the
yep.
clip
then he
notes
starts,
of this. Boom. Gwen Stefani walks into Jimmy's office.
Yep.
Shows him a tape, and he's like, "Ah, sorry, you just don't have it." And she gets mad. And he was like, "But here's what I'll do. I'm gonna buy you $100,000 worth of recording equipment for your garage, and I want you and your band, No Doubt, to work on your single that you think is gonna be it. And when you have it, come back here." So he buys her all the shit, sends an engineer over to teach them how to use it, and you're charged with writing a single. She comes back 6 months later. She's like, "I think I got it." Slaps it on his desk. He listens. And he goes, "No, keep working." She gets fucking pissed, goes out. 4 months later, comes back in, and she has "Don't Speak." And he goes, "Yep. Now you're ready."
And this is a great, and this
holy
is also
shit.
A fantastic segue into what we were already talking about. Iovine was a guy, he's a First Amendment type dude. And so, you know.
Oh, everybody hated
everyone
him.
Everyone hated him because.
When he was with NWA. NWA. And he started. But now the best part about this whole thing, not only did he find fucking Nine Inch Nails and Trent Reznor.
Oh, that's the other thing. So
and fucking Marilyn Manson.
Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Trent Manson Reznor were turned down by Manson. Everyone. The first two signings of Interscope when he spins off, Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson.
Well, he locks Marilyn.
He locks.
And
he locks
Reznor
Nails and Trent Reznor.
In
goes,
the house. In the house that Marilyn Monroe got killed in.
The same house.
Says, "You're going to fucking help him write a record." He said
yep.
that to Trent Reznor and said, "Help Marilyn Manson fucking create his whole thing."
What
so
the
then,
fuck?
So fast forward even more.
Yeah.
Jimmy Iovine is walking on the beach in yep. Malibu, and he looks up, and Dr. Dre is on the porch with a bunch of fucking Nike shoes everywhere. And he's like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "I don't know. Nike wants me to do a shoe." He goes, "No. Put all those in the trash. I'll be back tomorrow. You've never set foot on a basketball court in your life, motherfucker. You're a DJ." He comes back the next day with 400 pairs of headphones from all over the world. And he goes, "You're going to do headphones, Dre." And him and Jimmy Iovine and Dre created Beats.
Got it. I know who
oh,
he is
and
now.
As a little side note, after that, a weird-looking Jewish chick from Juilliard School of Arts walks into his office, and he goes, "I couldn't understand what the fuck she was saying. She was talking about Andy Warhol and this and that, and I was so confused, I just signed her Lady Gaga."
This is the best documentary.
It's the best
ever,
documentary. It's fucking
mind-blowing.
What's
this called? I've got to watch it.
The Undeniables or some shit like that.
It's
like the
documentary about Dre and Jimmy Iovine.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's fucking
on HBO.
Mind-blowing.
I can't remember what it's called. And Eminem. Eminem is a huge part of it because Dre
blew him through the fucking...
Well, Dre brought Eminem to Jimmy Iovine. And
yep.
He tells the story like... So that whole... intro scene in what was it EP where he's going into the you remember the first Eminem record where he goes in to the record label and the guy is like, I don't know, I think it's a little much, like this was all constructed by Jimmy Iovine. Like,
Em, shut the door.
Yeah.
It would have been better had you brought me nothing at all. How in the fuck? The record label told me to go fuck myself. I don't like to get told by Columbia to go fuck myself. That first EP, dude.
Oh,
I love that.
This
I love that
all,
track.
It's so good because it's like, holy fuck. And then at the end of the documentary, they tell you, you know, Beats sold for $4+ billion. It's because Dre and Jimmy Iovine came up with the first streaming music, and Apple Music is now it. That's what they bought.
And at the very end, when they interviewed Trent Reznor, did you notice what his title is?
The president of Apple Music.
Absolutely. That's how much.
No one knew that.
They don't even address
Reznor.
It. Trent Reznor, they put CEO of Apple Music. I'm like, that's how much fucking dick he was swinging, Jimmy Iovine.
Holy
he brought
shit.
To the largest company that's ever existed in the history of ever.
But Trent is one of the only people. He wrote an entire album and released it as public fucking property. Yep. He said, you can use this in any of your films, commercials, whatever you want. Here it is.
The number of soundtracks that guy's done, fucking like True Detective. That guy's fucking, he's insanely
True
fucking
Detective
talented.
He did.
Him and T-Bone Burnett. Like, he's been on some of the soundtrack. Like, that guy.
That's my one I would love to meet is Jimmy Iovine because he's also so cool. Like
he's so fucking cool.
Straight
dude.
Up, it doesn't matter who you are, if you're a waitress or another executive or whatever. He's just like, oh, hey, lovely.
And there's this whole thing
he's
that
this
at the
tiny little ball
at
guy.
The height of Fleetwood Mac's popularity. Stevie Nicks, who used to fuck him back in the day, which comes out, they used to bang. That's how much game this dude had. He was the skinny, weird looking dude. Had enough game. He was fucking Stevie Nicks. Stevie Nicks comes and says, I need a solo project. And he brings Tom Petty in. And now he's negotiating this. And literally, this is they're showing Tom Petty. And he goes, and she wanted me to write a song. And I was like, I don't know. And Jimmy said, come on, man. Give her a song or two. Which wound up both to be number one hits. The whole fucking deal. And she goes, I want to join your band. And fucking Tom Petty looks at the camera and goes, but there's no girls in the Heartbreakers. I was like, what a great fucking code line. But there's no girls in the Heartbreakers. I don't know. Yeah, dude.
It's such a good story.
It's amazing.
Like that would be my number one for lunch code to get Jimmy Iovine to fucking tell that story.
Yeah.
Because it is amazing. And that documentary is beautifully put together.
Okay. So we got to get the name for this.
I'm going to look it up now. Hang on.
Yeah.
The Defiant Ones.
Defiant Ones.
That's it.
There we go.
It's pretty pretty unbelievable, man.
Yeah.
And you because you go in thinking it's just about Eminem and Dr. Dre, and going in, I never knew the name Jimmy Iovine, and then they started connecting all these. I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Well, I knew him because I'm a huge Tom Petty fan. And, you know, that whole thing about where they spent a year almost on.
And he's so humble.
So fucking humble.
Like, when he's telling the story, he's like sitting in his. He's sitting in his backyard, like, and he's just like, oh, you know, and then, Tom Petty was like, maybe we should do a record. He's like, all right, that sounds cool.
it's for him being a guy who likes non-traditional shit, man. It's kind of like what you and I were talking about. Like, I did an Operation Comedy show. I got contacted about 2 years ago by a college, a huge college out here. I won't say which one. And they were like, listen, will you do a show for us and we'll give the money to a military charity of your choice? And I was like, I don't see how we could lose.
Right.
But in my brain, I was like, fuck, dude, nobody's doing college shows anymore. Nobody.
Nobody? Really?
Dayton Cook.
Fuck no,
that's like the most offended place on earth.
Dude, you talk about risk reward. You talk about walking in. Like when Ross on our last podcast was talking about how like that was really a rough spot you went into. No, it wasn't. It was a bunch of rowdy, drunk people already laughing and having a good time.
Right.
Rough is going into a bunch of fucking entitled rich college kids. And that's not shit. But I've never believed that. I think the media grabs whatever extreme of either side. That's what's good. I've never believed that young people who fuck and smoke dope and drink don't want to laugh. I just never believed that.
Do they still do that, though? Colleges?
Yeah. Yes,
no,
yes, yes.
I think it's died down,
man,
actually. No, because there's been some
really
complaints.
Fucking lame.
There's a lot of complaints from the female side saying guys are too scared to even talk to them anymore.
Oh, you know what, though, man? That's great. You know what I love about what's... Anyway, I'll get back to that.
That's opportunity. That's what I would say.
Yeah,
dude,
that's opportunity.
Dude, the reason I date so many younger women is not because I go looking for them with a bag of Hershey Kiss in my pocket. It's because these fucking idiots don't know how to make girls laugh and talk to them anymore. Back in the day before social media shit, back in my day, get off my lawn, but you had to know how to walk up to a girl, get her attention, make her laugh, and ultimately get her to fuck you. These guys don't know how to do that. They want a pen pal. They want to do this shit. So when you've talked to a girl for 3 minutes, you're just like, listen, I'm really enjoying this conversation. You want to go grab a glass of wine? They literally look at you like,
wait, what?
Wait, what? Yeah.
Oh,
we can just get some appetizers.
You're going to pay?
Yeah. You asked me out to dinner. You asked me to my face. So anyway, real quick.
So you're like next level to most of these fucking women right now. You're asking them on a date to their face.
While I'm making them laugh, though.
That's a super interesting scenario because most people are meeting on the internet now, right?
Right. And look, and there's a lot of women that are into that and get that. But I'm telling you, man, like there's still a section of women that just want a regular ass dude.
But that's like most people. I mean, we've got a couple few billion years of evolution. How you interact and how you pick up women, like there you go. You're going to be ahead of the game doing that. Like,
yeah.
How many women do you go through on a weekly basis?
Not consensually.
Well, monthly.
That's
on an average. Couple?
Two? Yeah. I got one guy.
Sure.
I made the sound guy
mainly
laugh.
App driven.
Yeah, but mostly because of the schedule. Like, we're not out in public very
much.
Yeah,
I understand that. But how many women have you picked up face to face?
Face to plenty.
In the last 6 months?
Well, in the last 6 months, one.
One?
Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't even tell you the last time I did that. I don't think, I don't even remember.
Before I was married, like, that was it, man.
Yeah.
Like, that was it. Like, I mean, there's like a few things going out, you know, Match and a few of these things, but not like there is today. But yeah, I'd walk into it.
You can get real specific now.
But even 6 years ago, before I met my wife, I'd walk into some place and just be like, hey, how's it going? What's up? Mm-hmm. And strike up a conversation. And that was 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Where that was even unorthodox back then.
Yeah.
Where people were like, Chicks were like, whoa, blown away by it. Like, you're like the first person that's really talked to me.
Yeah.
So I could punch way above my weight all the fucking time.
And you know, man, that was one of the great things about the military, man, is at 18 years old, everything, my entire support network that I'd used to get laid, my friends, my familiarity, the school, all that was gone. And I was suddenly, you know, a free agent. And I was going to Austin, Texas with a fake ID at 18, and you got to get laid. I mean, I'm not saying you force yourself on nobody, but you're motivated. I'm going to be funny and I'm going to go up to you and I'm going to ask you to dance. And now if you see me on a dance floor, call the FBI because I've been drugged and fucking somebody's holding me against my will. But back then that was the drive, man. Like in the Serengeti, when you see the fucking, you know, the crocodiles are going where the water is.
Right.
Like that's where the fucking action is, and that's what I feel like these younger dudes are missing. And that's why, I mean, I got no wife, no kids. I live a very simple lifestyle, and I'm not really into old man middle aged shit. So I like to date 25, 26 year olds.
What's old man middle aged shit?
You know, man, like, well, we got to pick up my kid, and you know, my kid's kid, and you know, I've got this, and
well, nobody's
you know,
into that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I chose comedy because I like
lawns. You know, they like mowing lawns.
yeah,
chopping wood.
Yeah, none of
maybe picking out Pergo. You know,
chopping wood's fun.
Putting up wood paneling.
Chopping wood
in
is
your
fucking
house.
Great, dude.
Yeah, it is.
Chopping wood is
swinging
fucking
an
great.
Axe into a fucking
so underrated.
Block and it's fucking legit.
I like the big. What's it called?
Dick.
The lock splitter.
Well, yeah, hold on. Let me ask you just a regular question. We're all about the same age. Wasn't there a point when you were a young man where your dad took you out with an axe and explained to you how to cut a fucking... like?
Yes, but let me also add this. There was a point when I was 18 years old that my girlfriend could not go out with me that night until a whole fucking pile of firewood was split. And I fucking did it.
Pussy's
by
a motivator. Pussy's a hell of a motivating
she
factor.
Fucking sat and watched.
Right.
And I just feel like a lot of young kids have never experienced that.
Yeah, man. I mean, and well, again,
I grew up as a logger's son, so like my dad was a professional in Northern Idaho.
Oh shit! Damn.
So my dad was like a professional wood guy. Like when he taught me how to cut a fucking tree down, it was with a chainsaw. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, this is what you're going to do. And oh, by the way, if you fuck this up, it's going to kill you. So I remember that sticking in my brain relatively well. And I also remember my first chores were involving wood. Like everything was involving chopping, splitting, stacking, carrying.
Yep.
It was all manual labor. Everything I did. So I remember that very prominently.
Just understanding what a cord of wood is probably a skill that doesn't exist anymore.
I register that, and that's been like back to five, I would imagine.
Yeah. And my dad
know how much a cord.
And my dad was white collar. He was a lawyer, but he knew that we came from coal miners, and he didn't want his son to be a pussy. So even though he knew I'd never swing an axe in my life, it still was like, yo, you a Renaissance man. needs to understand how to do certain. You need to learn how to fire a weapon. You should learn how to ride a horse. You should learn how to speak another language. You need to learn what a right cross is. Like, there's just certain, you know.
We never. I'm sad we never got into that with Matt. I want you to give a little bit of your Spanish set to Evan, because that's really fucking impressive. It is.
I just thought it was impressive. I told him this earlier. I was like, man, I'm not trying to be a dick, but you came out of education, essentially. And I wouldn't have, I would not have pinned that on you whatsoever. If you would have walked into this room cold, sat on the couch for an hour, not talked about anything, I would have been like, you didn't come out of education. There's no fucking way. There's no way. But you did. Where were you teaching?
Indiana University, man.
Right.
So
awesome.
I'll try to give you the quick version, but Indiana University's had a program since the 60s called the IU Honors Program. And in the 60s, there was France, Germany, Spain, Italy, and Mexico. So my old man, who also went to Indiana University, did that program in 1964 for French in Strasbourg. So fast forward, in 1992, I'm a senior or junior in high, or 1991, I'm a junior in high school. They're still doing the same program. So I take the test, much like I did the D-Lab. I was an average student. I didn't really give a fuck that much, but the linguistic DNA was obviously in me. So I aced all the tests, and I got to go to Mexico to study, and within 8 days of being in Mexico, I was completely fluent in the language. It was fucking insanity. It was like you took a duck. Yeah, dude. It was fucking insanity, man. Like, fluent. Now, also, because I got in a lot of trouble, I wasn't hanging out with all the American kids speaking English. I was going out to bars. I was getting laid. I was getting in trouble. I was hanging out with Mexicans and learning fucking Spanish. Came back, majored in language, graduated with a 3.9 GPA, went to work for Eli Lilly, which is one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world, Prozac, out of Indianapolis, working in their national business department, and fucking hated it, dude. I wound up in a cubicle. I thought it was going to be like, I'm going to be James Bond. I'm going to be international on jets and wearing tuxedos. Right. And nah, motherfucker, you are in a cubicle. Went out to have lunch with one of my professors, and he was like, you know, we had an emergency cancellation due to a professor. You want to teach? And I was just like, are you serious? I was like, I don't have a master's. And he goes, we all talked about it already. You have a 4.0 in your, because I had a 4.0 within my area of concentration, which was Spanish and, you know, linguistics. So they said, as long as you're working on a master's, we can okay it. And then once I got into it, man, I loved it, because the lowest level is the night advanced classes, because that's the one that the dregs and the working people take. But right. I loved it, because I taught only twice a week, but it was for 3.5 hours. Instead of three times a week for an hour and a half, it was twice a week for 3.5 hours. This is totally what led to stand-up. So I had 3 hours to just lecture, and because it was a night class, I never got audited.
Right.
Nobody was fucking with me. I just had free reign. And also, no one had ever had a young dude incorporate the Pacers and the Colts, and, you know, I was basically doing stand-up. I mean, because I just could lecture. I could create my own lesson plans. It was fucking amazing. And I really got into it. And then I went to Spain, because part of the MAT program at IU is consecutive summers in Salamanca, Spain. You have to complete two of those. And after the first one, I was like, I just love this, man. It was a great fit. The problem was I was fucking a lot of my students. A lot of them. I wound up marrying one of my students.
Strong.
Not really, but man, how do you not do that?
You don't.
Anywhere. I'm talking when you're a 29-year-old dude, which I was.
No, that was my dream. That was my dream. My
Van Halen,
dream,
dude.
My dream was I just wanted to teach philosophy and bang undergrads and get fucked up for the rest of my life.
So you
that
wanted
was my
to be
dream.
Indiana Jones?
No, philosophy.
But like, what do you think?
Philosophy, not.
No, I just wanted to teach philosophy because it's bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just bullshit.
Yeah.
So you
just
like,
justify your own existence.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, whatever.
Absolutely.
Blah, blah, blah,
that's
blah.
Why, dude.
I think therefore
and then,
I am.
And then you're like, hey, let's get fucked up in my hot tub a little later. Well, I think you deserve an A.
Of all the
that was it.
Of all the social sciences, philosophy is probably the one that's most closely related to hallucinogens, so I like it.
I still, to this day, listen to philosophy fucking podcasts, actually.
You know Timothy Leary, the guy who brought LSD to the United States?
I know him well.
He
As a Grateful Dead fan, I know.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you're a Deadhead. Me too.
Well, you know, I'm a huge Deadhead. Yeah.
The
same.
The song "Come Together."
See, man, this is why you don't fucking judge people. Yeah. If you would have put a gun to my head and been like, "What's the last band this dude listens to?" I would have been like, "Same."
Not the
I
dead.
Love the Dead, dude.
Yeah.
And he ran for governor of California too.
Yeah,
Timothy
he did.
Did. Yeah,
he did.
And that song "Come Together" by the Beatles—that's what it's about. It was supposed to be his campaign song. A lot of people don't know.
Get
that.
Get the fuck out! You're a Deadhead. No shit.
Huge Deadhead. Yeah, man.
Same.
Yeah.
That's when I came around on John Mayer. I thought he was this poppy.
John Mayer is fucking great, man.
John Mayer is a fucking shredder.
So he is a fucking hardcore musician.
Yes.
So Jackie Green, do you know who he is?
Yes.
So Jackie Green is a friend of mine. I was on the Middle Fork of the Salmon last
year.
How'd you
meet him?
My rafting company took him on a rafting trip, and he and I became friends. And so, like, my buddy and I were like, he's like, "Hey, man, we're going to have a bunch of musicians on this trip. Are you cool with it?" I was like, "Well, who are they?" He's like, "Well, Jackie Green." I'm like, "Fucking A."
Done.
Hell yeah. So Jackie is an awesome dude. Like, he's an epic musician. He's an incredible person. But talk about a fucking really cool trip. Just a week of, like, Dead covers and Jackie and a bunch of stuff in the middle of the mountains.
Oh, my God.
So... super fucking cool. Actually, I think he's out here. No, he's in San Fran. But either way, like, yeah, he's dead.
I just
Who were you talking about?
Timothy Leary.
Yeah.
So he was a professor at Harvard.
CIA.
And he started getting shipments. So one of his students came back with LSD and like a full-on mason jar completely laced with sugar. It's sugar laced with LSD. Like, who knows what the potency of that shit was. But he started taking it himself, giving it to his students.
Right.
And then he kind of went off the deep end a little bit, as one might when you take acid every day. I've done it.
As one might.
Yeah.
I've done that trip for 3 years.
He made these, like, guided meditation tapes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It is the craziest shit I've ever heard in my life.
Tune in, drop out, man.
Yeah, tune in, drop out. It's fucking crazy.
Did you see the Netflix documentary? I think it's called The Sunshine Boys, about the two original dudes who came up with acid. Pre-Timothy Leary.
The Sunshine Boys?
I mean, think it's called...
Albert Hoffman.
Can you look that up, bro? Can you look up LSD documentary on Netflix? It blew my fucking mind, the real story. Like, the shit we have been fed... Do what? Sunshine Makers.
Yeah.
Blew my fucking mind, dude. Unbelievable. Basically, it was the two guys who wanted no profit, who were literally like, "We're going to alter the conscience of the entire planet." So they had enough LSD, they were going to dump it in the water to get the entire world to trip. Anyway, just if you get a chance to watch it, it's fucking unbelievable.
Oh, this is about agency scientists using LSD.
Right.
That's so there's a couple of big stories. One of them, they took six scientists, they brought them in for a summit meeting, like a meeting of the minds.
Yeah.
They're in what would essentially be an Airbnb now.
And didn't tell them.
They dosed them all up, didn't tell them. One guy jumped out and killed himself.
Of course.
And then his son.
Out of the window.
Yeah, his son. His
that was
son
another documentary.
That was another Netflix special.
Yeah, I watched
special.
Yeah, that's like 10 years ago, I think, that one came out. That was forever.
So
yeah.
Did you, when were you doing the dirty acid when you were watching The Dead like I was?
Never done acid a day in my life. Not a second.
What attracted you to them originally?
The funny thing is, so I grew up in the middle of Idaho. Logger dad, ultra conservative. No impact whatsoever, and meaning, like, there's no way for me to have, I guess, an outlet or even an inlet to the Dead. And I was listening to some fucking album sometime, and I think it was probably like Touch of Grey or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what it was. I was like,
in the dark,
these guys are great, man.
Yeah,
and so I was turned on to them super early, became a fan, and then. I was always like, not the token Deadhead. There's no way because there's not really a token Deadhead. But even within Special Forces and the entire community, there's not a lot of fucking Deadheads. So when
you're
you meet
the first dude.
So when you meet them, you're like, "Oh, I'm a fucking huge Deadhead." So I was going to their last concert '95 before
August.
August of '95.
Yeah,
had tickets to the show. And I was like, man, I'll just catch the next one. I was actually going to go on this other trip.
Same thing I did with Tom Petty at the Hollywood Bowl. Had free tickets.
Died.
Fuck.
All right. And but I mean, I have like original vinyl. I have a box of Dead shows, like taped Dead shows. I have over 300 Dead shows on tape.
No shit. On tape.
Not like fucking like on tape.
And if you're listening to this and you think the Dead's a bunch of hippie pussy jam bandy
They're
motherfuckers, you're out of your mind.
They're
amazing. Are because I love real country. I come from Kentucky coal miners. So people think when I shit on country in my act, which I do, I'm shitting on that bro country, Merle, fucking Hank Sr., all that. I mean, I could get into a million different. It's unfucking believably good music. And the Dead at their core are bluegrass country.
They're bluegrass.
Bluegrass, dude.
They're real. Bluegrass, psychedelic. And when we really look break it down, the thing that I love about them is they made a new genre of music. They forged this entire way, which you said earlier. They're bridge makers and they're the people that cross it, right?
Bridge crossers.
They fucking made something
bridge
that
makers,
didn't
for
exist.
Sure.
They didn't exist. They sold out live show after live show after live show. They were the most sold out and might be still the same or the most sold out live show musicians in the history.
And did it in like Metallica, two of my favorite bands.
That's right.
I was going to say Metallica's
the first
Metallica.
But what they have in common, the first number one hit, the Dead started in 67. Their first number one hit was Touch of Grey.
Touch of Grey.
They were selling
Touch
out arenas with no radio play.
Exactly.
Metallica, until fucking one, had never had a single radio song. They were selling out arenas with no radio play pre-internet.
Jesus.
One was
arenas.
Their first arena.
They had 70
for four albums.
How was it?
People were fucking waiting in line for 72 hours.
Word of mouth, man. It's the same reason we all know that Mikey died from fucking eating Pop Rocks and Coke. It was just back then, word of mouth. Shit got out, man.
72 hours.
That
like,
is
people would be waiting to try to get into a fucking stadium and buy scalped tickets.
Yep.
Like camped out trying to fucking.
And what
get
they
the
both
stadium.
Have in common, man, is no matter what you heard on the album, when you went to see him live, man, I saw Metallica. I've been listening to Metallica since I was 12 years old. Weightlifting Metallica have been a staple of my life since I was a kid. I saw him at the fucking Rose Bowl. If you have a chance to see any band in 100, I've never seen a 100,000 seat arena show. I mean, the Rose Bowl, that's 100,000 people. Fucking Metallica. Absolutely slaughtered. And what I love about them is from the day they came out until now, they have been the hardest, nastiest. So when you drop $500 on a Metallica ticket, it's like Tool. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, when you leave, you're not going to think at all about what you spent. You're just going to leave going, that was fucking insanity.
That was one of the things they said. It was like, hey, we're a working band.
Yeah.
We're not cutting fucking albums, we're not cutting corners, we're a working band. We tour, we put on shows, and we put on shows for people that enjoy our music.
Totally.
That's what we do. Nothing's the same. It's like, and I really like that impromptu style where it's like, hey, you're just gonna fucking play and you go off. And by the way, yeah, they were fucking whacked out on whatever they were doing, like combination of hallucinogenics and fucking uppers, downers, all of it, right? But the shit was different every
fucking time. Depending on the dose Jerry had taken. Because the rest of the band was tight, but the problem was with Jerry,
Jerry's
never knew which Jerry
up.
You were getting.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like, you know, Steven Tyler and Joe Perry, where maybe a bottle of Jack got busted on someone's head, but the show was good. Jerry might be drooling, falling off the stool.
Up.
Like,
that's great.
Quaaludes don't fuck around, man.
Yeah, they don't fuck around.
That's true, dude.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
There's a reason they took them away.
Yeah.
Did we just stall out right there?
Not at all. Not at all.
Not at all.
I'm trying to think. All right. So we just finished with music. I want to go back to fucking comics.
Yeah.
I didn't get to tell you who my favorite comic is.
Dane Cook. Hands down is Jared's favorite comic.
No. Eddie Izzard.
Eddie Izzard. Oh, shit.
All the fucking.
Yes. Again, I should not judge you, brother. Again,
Eddie Izzard,
stand up in other languages.
Eddie Izzard, he does it French. He does the whole
crazy.
Thing in French.
He does stand up in languages he doesn't speak. I'm not kidding.
I'm fluent in Spanish. It wasn't that difficult. He does a set in French. He doesn't speak French fluently.
No.
That's fucking mind-blowing. If you've never learned another language.
He did Dress to Kill in French.
Dress to Kill in French, and it's not even his fucking secondary language.
That's amazing.
Mind-blowing.
But the thing was with him is you listen to Circle or fucking Circus, and then it was Circus, Circle.
Circus, Circle, and then.
And then Dress to Kill. Dude. You feel like you just got done with a fucking 2-hour history lecture, and you're like, wait.
Yeah.
Did all that stuff really happen?
Yeah, he came up during an age when everything was observational comedy. Yeah.
Everything Seinfeld was stereotypical, racial, sexual.
Yeah, he wasn't much of a topical guy. He was like talking about, you know, the Victorian era in England and shit.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, the Church of
England. And he's up there.
Druids.
Yeah.
Right.
In drag.
In drag.
20 years ago.
In an arena.
Yeah.
Not a theater.
And he says, he goes,
fucking arena.
I'm an executive transvestite.
Exactly.
I'm not a gay man. what was he called? It? You know, running, jumping, climbing trees, putting on makeup when you get up there.
Bro. Yeah. And this is what I love about...
Weirdo transvestite. It's executive transvestite.
And this is what I love about stand-up being the ultimate, you know, people who are attracted to that stay true to it. When I started, I started producing the first ever all Spanish shows at the Comedy Store. It was called Comedia Toda Madre. It was a total risk and it absolutely blew up in my face.
You have to do this for him. I want him to see this because you did it for us.
What, like my opening joke?
Yes, yes.
Me llamo John, soy de Indiana, soy güero obviamente, pero de todas las modas, si no me equivoco, soy el único güero en los Estados Unidos que puede hacer stand-up completamente en español, pero si no me equivoco, es un gran ventaja porque para mí yo puedo trabajar en shows como este. Yo sé lo que están pensando ustedes ahora mismo, este pinche gringo robándole trabajos a los comediantes hispanos. Simón, un gringo robándole trabajos a un comediante hispano. En la época de puto Trump, es la más grande ironía que nada.
So you're going to have to translate the joke for me now.
I mean,
well.
Does it even translate?
No. And you know what's great is it's rare you get
He's
to talk to somebody
their mind
who understands.
A white guy is walking up and doing the fucking show in Spanish.
It's great.
So that's my opener, and they're literally just sitting there like, wait, what? And what I would do is I'd walk out, and I always went third. So there were other Latino comics, and I'd walk out, and I'd go, hey, guys, how you doing? And there would be nothing. And I'd see jaws open, and I'd go, so before I get started, I just want to tell you guys, tranquilos culeros, no soy migra, which is relax, motherfuckers, I ain't immigration. And it would fucking destroy like a fucking atom bomb. Because I'd already learned that as, you know, and if Ross were still here, man, one of the advantages, you know, when I did black rooms all those years on the road, that shit works to your advantage. Because the minute you walk out, the level of expectation bottoms the fuck out. They're just like, what the fuck? And when you not only speak Spanish, so I started talking, what I was able to pull was I started doing jokes about what it's like to learn Spanish as a white guy. So all that shit in my master's and everything that I thought I'd never use again, all of a sudden it became relevant again because the jokes, the relatability of them, because they've all, as immigrants,
tried to teach somebody
how to fuck. Exactly. And so it started, and I was like, fuck this actually. But actually I got sidetracked, but so a friend of mine, this Mexican comic, calls me up and he goes, hey, you got to see this dude named Fabrizio Capano. And I'm like, never heard of him. He's like, can we put him on your show? I'm like, dude, I've never even heard of him. He goes, just trust me, he's funny. I go to this dude's Instagram. He's got 485,000 followers and just filmed a Netflix special in a fucking soccer arena in Chile.
We're drinking tonight on Drinking Bros.
Did that come through? Sorry. Yeah, I've been drinking. I've been drinking with these guys a lot. This Budweiser is going down great. Fabrizio is a fucking rock star in South America. He's one of the only comedians down there. He's killing. And when I see him, he's at the Haha Cafe in front of fucking three people heckling him because his accent's weird.
Seriously?
Because this guy loves comedy so much. And this is when I fell in love with him, and he's still my boy. It wouldn't matter if you looked him up. You wouldn't understand shit he's saying, but his jokes are great in English. So I asked him, I go, dude, I know who you are. You're rich already.
you're a monster. What are you doing here? He's like, because I want people to like me all over and be funny all over. Eating his dick in front of three assholes at the Ha Ha Cafe in North Hollywood. Because he just that grind, that purity of, and that's what they always say, man. If you won the lottery, would you ever do any job? And if I won $10 trillion tomorrow, I'd still do stand-up. And you see it every day with these guys. Fabrizio Capano. Netflix special come out, filmed in a soccer arena. Kevin Hart-style shit. Still comes back to L.A. because he cares that much. He's like, I want to do this, man. I want to, and that's what's unbelievable about stand-up, dude.
I like for people that haven't seen you before, like I think where I was introduced was your dad, the bit on your dad that.
Yeah.
You know which one I'm talking about, yeah. Right? Which was super fucking funny.
Thank you. It's
fucking hilarious.
I wrote a paper on that in Spanish about the word fuck.
Seriously?
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
That
yeah.
comes from a paper I wrote in graduate school.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that makes way more sense. So I looked it up on YouTube.
Do I sound cunty when I say that? Do I sound like
no,
in graduate
man,
school?
No,
I wrote
no,
a paper.
No. You were a fucking GI dude. We're all happy.
Yeah,
somebody,
right, dude.
Somebody
yeah.
went to fucking college out of all of
hey,
us.
Hey, good on you.
Whatever.
Dan went to college.
I've got like 18 degrees and I've never used any of them for
asshole.
Yeah. I had neither till this stand up thing with Spanish, but I was like, thank fucking God I didn't waste 4 years of my life.
But you've obviously done a ton of fucking stand up.
Yes.
And where are you going? Like, what is it? When I say, like, everybody wants something they want to do.
Yeah.
Right? So when you look down the road and you're like, man, what do I want to do? What is it that you want to do?
Well, so here's the thing, man, is stage time is incredibly hard to get in L.A. and New York. It's almost impossible. So what I always tell new comics, and this is not new advice, but learn, stay in your little community as long as you can. Because you'll be a big fish in a small pond. Don't come out to L.A. and then think you're going to learn how to be a comic. You can get better here for sure, but don't think, hey, I'm going to come out here and learn. I was 35 years old, man, and I went to one open mic, stood in line for 3 hours, and had some fucking dude who was 4 feet tall call me an asshole, and I was like, I'm going to kill somebody, man. I don't have the temperament for this. So I just started doing my own thing. I started Operation Comedy. I started producing theaters, and then I wound up showcasing for this guy who books all the improvs and funny bones. And he was just like, is one dude out of Columbus, Ohio named Dave Stroop. And I got a showcase for him. Got lucky as fuck and murdered. And he was just like, dude, I've been looking for a white boy who can kill black rooms. You're going to destroy. So went on the road for 5 years with, you know, some of the biggest black headliners in the world. That's where I learned how to be a stand-up. But at the same time, I was working on production with Operation Comedy shows. I had corporate sponsors. I had theaters. I would bring in bigger acts. So, to be perfectly frank, man, I've always been wild as fuck. I cannot be controlled. I hate authority.
Yeah, but you're also maintaining all these roles of promoter, producer,
yes,
everything. You've yeah. been doing this all by yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, like HBO special, like the Apollo. Like that's what I'm asking, man.
I mean, obviously, you know,
like,
I want...
When are you going to look into it and go, like, got it? Fucking A.
You never get it
never?
In stand-up,
got
and
it.
That's what's great about it. It's so... You're never... You know, I was hanging out the other night with a songwriter, very successful female songwriter, and I asked her, I go, so, like, when you write a song, it just... You vomited it out, and you're just done with it? And she was like, yep. And I go, you never go back and rethink it? And she's like, nope. And she's like, don't you? And I'm like, it's the opposite for us. Like, we spend obsessing over every, does the go there?
Just
does it?
Little tweaks and everything.
Constant.
Even when you get your special, you're like, you're already writing your next special.
Yeah.
All right, I can fix
And the
fix
minute
this.
You record your special, it's
I mean,
like a known thing.
Taking Eddie Izzard, for example, you go from Circus to Circle to Dress to Kill. Generally, it's the same act.
Yep.
But he just fucking mastered that motherfucker. Yeah.
There's literally times where, man, you've had a joke for 3 years on the road, and then one day it just comes to you like a thunderbolt, and you're like, I wonder if I put Red and House at the beginning, at the end,
right?
And it changes. Like, it's, I know that sounds cliche, but it's...
Right.
So obviously I want an hour Netflix special, but the Operation Comedy thing I found is really, really...
something different and special. And to be honest with you, man, I did it, a lot of it so I could side, you know. So, but when I moved to LA, I had a lot of people who'd already worked with me in the Midwest that were like, this guy's on the up and up. When he says he's going to do some shit, it's actually going to happen. And that I was able to jump a ton of the lines just by having people going, you know, he did it in Chicago, he did it in Nashville, he did it in Louisville, come out here.
Are there other veteran comedies that your comedians that you've seen out there right now?
I mean, not really, man. And I think a lot of, as we well know, a lot of times veterans think just because they're a veteran, someone should hand them some shit, and they slack on their actual product, which has to be undeniable.
Correct.
I don't give a fuck what you did in Iraq.
Amen.
Or wherever. So like Don O'Rawlings, dude. I do a show every year at the Naval Academy. And it's hilarious. So things have been going well, and I've been bringing them the right guys, and they'd been killing. But we got a PAO who is, you know, a little younger in social media, you know, tied in. He goes, I want a big name. I got a budget. And I go, you sure? Because I'll bring in a big name, but they're going to say some shit because you ain't going to pay them real money. Real money means $600,000 because you're not buying them out for a Saturday. You're buying them out for that whole weekend. So that means basically you're buying them out for the five shows they would have done. And he was like, we got a budget. And I'm like, for real? I got real money? He's like, yes. And they can say whatever they want. He's like, pretty much. But we want a vet. I can sell that to the command. You know Don O'Rawlings, Ashy Larry from the Chappelle Show?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
Fucking hilarious.
Bro.
His stand-up is savage as fuck,
dog, too. Yeah. I'm telling you right now, I don't give a fuck what you've seen of Don O'Rawlings on TV or whatever. He is, like, when you go to the Comedy Store, there's certain people that when you see him on a lineup, it's fascinating to watch the interplay of, like, I've done a show where Jim Jefferies called me up and he was like, hey, I'm going to do a drop-in. And I put him on the list. And I watched another huge name comic walk in. Hey, what's up? Fucking, yeah. Look at the list, see where he was, and literally just shrink.
Seriously.
Trying to figure out how to come to me to go, I need a different spot. Because there's no fucking way I'm following this dude. Like, he's going to... He's looking at me, and what he says is like, why would you put him there? I'm like, because he goes up wherever the fuck he wants, because he's working for free. That's how this works. These guys drop in, they do whatever the fuck they want. That's just how the fuck it works, man.
Are you still active in the Comedy Store? Do you do a ton of stuff?
Yeah. I still go there. I still perform. But I just didn't have the relationships that you need to be able to regularly produce shows. Like Sam Tripoli took my place, and he should have, man. He's so much better than I am because he grew up with these dudes. He's known them forever. He can call Joe Rogan up. Hey man, you popping in on a Tuesday? Like I didn't have that. I'm still an outsider. But then when I went to the American Legion in Hollywood, it was perfect timing because they had just put $6 million into that place and needed people to do big time 600-700 seaters. And I had Live Nation.
You're getting a fucking good repertoire on your own. I mean, you had Bob Saget, Jeff Ross.
Yes,
fucking.
Yeah, Bill Burr.
Those guys are fucking great,
yeah,
man.
Ron That's White. A pretty fucking good lineup, John.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, man.
It's a fucking huge lineup.
Yeah, because like, what these guys want is just not to be fucked around, man. They just want a place.
Jeff Ross was great.
Jeff Ross is fucking incredible, man.
Jeff Ross is incredible,
man. Fucking incredible.
I love that guy,
Bob Saget is fucking incredible,
and
man.
All Jeff Ross does up there is fucking make fun of the whole crowd.
Dude.
Yeah.
This is a story I was going to go into earlier about why I don't, I don't think Seinfeld's that great. There's a club in Thank you very much.
By the way, I'm with you because compared to all these other fucking names that we've thrown out,
right,
dude? He's not even like if you're picking a lineup, and I'm not taking anything away from him because he developed an incredible TV show and it was an amazing.
Larry David developed that motherfucker,
but with him, right?
Yes.
So for sure, like positive accolades all around, but. If you're stacking guys that you're like, I'm going to stack the bench, and I've got a 10-hour fucking road trip, and these are the guys that I'm going to listen to, he's not even on the roster, dude.
No, and there's
he's not even on the roster.
To me, Seinfeld's like Nickelback, kind of. It's like very cookie-cutter stuff.
Well, some of his stuff is fucking good, man.
I think
some of his more, like, some of his weirder shit is super funny to me, because I like the way his brain works and stuff.
A lot of people do. A lot of people love him, man. And I mean a lot. And to be clear, I know a lot of like A-list comics I've worked with that have worked with him that are like, that guy's a fucking genius. So this could very much be like Family Guy. I'm probably the issue. But there's a club in Hermosa Beach that Jay Leno is the part owner of.
Right.
The Hermosa Comedy and Magic. Okay. It's the only club in the entire world where they have a two drink maximum.
Shut the fuck up.
Because they don't want people to be drunk. They don't want them heckling. So where?
What?
Oh yeah. That's that why you'll lame, never see dude. You'll never see Jerry Seinfeld, Ray Romano. Those motherfuckers don't go to the store. Here's my Ron White story I was going to tell you last time.
Yeah, please.
Monday nights at the Improv, they do Mo Better Mondays, run by D. Ray Davis. It's the longest running urban show in all of Hollywood. D. Ray kills this motherfucker. He gets A-list black dudes front to back. It's unapologetic black show. The first time I meet Ron White, this fucking Escalade pulls up. Door opens. He's got this beautiful fucking Latin woman. He gets out in a tuxedo. No shit. He's got a fucking blunt and a bottle of scotch. Stumbles out, and the lady who runs the Improv walks up, and she immediately sees him, and she goes, "Oh, Ronnie, honey, come here for a second." And I just had me stand there because I was producing the early show. And she goes, "Oh, Ronnie, it's Black Night." And Ron goes, "I don't give a fuck." And she goes, "Yeah, it's all black comedians." He goes, "I don't give a fuck. I want to go up." This is the kind of shit I respect. This is a real nightclub comic. Got up and fucking murdered. And he had this bit about duck pussy taco, duck baby duck pussy lip tacos, which was on his last special, which is fucking out there, bro. Even if you're white and a Ron White fan, you're like, what is he talking about? It took a full 2 or 3 minutes, man, to warm these brothers up. But once he got going, he fucking slaughtered. Jerry Seinfeld will never do that. He only goes to the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach because it's safe. He's not going to get heckled. It's. And I'll be honest, man. Like I just, to me, part of being a comedian,
you got to take that risk.
You got to take that risk, man. You got to go to other rooms. You got to be. I'll tell you right now.
Build those calluses.
Who is it right now? Like, if you were to say, "Hey," and we asked you who your favorite comics are, but when you're like, man, I respect what this guy fucking brings to the table. Outside of Ron White, Bill Burr, who else are you looking at? You're like, dude.
Jim Jefferies, dude.
Yeah.
I did that college show I did. I put out some feelers and got some huge names that came back early. Right off the bat, they were like, we'll do it. And I was like, it's a college show. They're like, I don't give a fuck. I said, I'll try to front load it with vets, but it's a college show, man. They're going to come. He's like, great. And this is why I don't really buy into the whole, you know, young people are offended by everything. So Jefferies jumps on last minute. He's like, I'll do it, man. And he's like, but I need to go here. I'll be honest, this was like 4 years ago. I didn't really know his comedy that well. Bro, when I say he hit everything from guns to retards to abortion to rape to slavery.
All the good things.
All the good things.
But he did it in such a smart, cerebral way.
Elegant.
That literally standing O. We're talking 20 minutes into set. He closes with a bit that a year later, once he worked it out, was on his Netflix special about autism, where he takes his son in to get fucking diagnosed for autism, and the doc at the end is like, you're the one with autism. And I'm not even remotely doing it justice. It's a whole... Dude, it's like a 15-minute bit. It's fucking brilliant, and I rarely use that word. That guy standing O from a college crowd, 30-minute set. And now there's 45 minutes left of comedy. Everyone in that room knew the show was done. At that point, the minute he walked off stage, even though there were three more A-list, everyone was just like, this dude just fucking, he just face-fucked everybody. Let's see. In terms of guys that are really, you know, guys you may not have heard of, guys I love is, you know, Chris Porter. I don't know if you ever heard of Chris Porter. Yep. Chris Porter was, I think he either won or was runner-up on Last Comic Standing when it was really a show. And he was one of the first people who ever had a Netflix special called Ugly and Angry. Chris Porter's fucking, like, I piss myself when I listen to him. Yeah, he's that funny. Ian Bagg is another dude, Canadian cat. You talk about a guy that you may not have heard of, when he's on the list, he's the number one person I get asked by other A-list dudes to shuffle when they see his name on a list. Because nobody wants to follow that dude. His crowd work is second to fucking none, dude. He just gets up, if he's not on the road for a paid show, he's bringing 30 minutes of just, what are you doing? What do you do? What's your job? You can't follow that, man. You can't follow that with prep material. Like, he's a fucking monster. Ali Wong is somebody. I don't know if you guys know who she is. Who really, really, man, has a ton of respect. Yeah, those are some of the people I watch and really, really like, man.
Who are some comedians you miss? Like, I miss Zach Galifianakis' stand-up because he was just absolutely absolute insanity the whole time.
Yeah.
And obviously,
it was a good piano bit with just
yeah, what was
rubbish.
That garlic onion thing that he did?
Purple Onion. Live at the Purple Onion.
Yeah, live at the Purple Onion. Onion.
Yeah. It's a great show.
I mean, I know.
But there's a lot of guys who just, like, they got whatever other measure of success and quit doing stand-up.
You know, and I truly believe this, man, the great stand-ups, and I don't think there's ever been an exception in the history of stand-up, that's really all they do. You can't also be an actor and a podcaster and a, you know, this and that. The greats, that's all the fuck they do. Now, they may do ancillary acting jobs, but at the end of the day, that's something just to drive traffic for them as stand-ups. I mean, when like to me, Dave Attell.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about a motherfucker.
He grinds it out, too.
Like, if you ask me right now, hey, man, you got, here's 20 bucks. Like, and Bill Burr is one of the greatest. I've just seen him a lot recently because I've been working with him. Fucking Dave Attell is out of this. Like, I mean, for us, it's almost like watching Hendrix, man. Like, you're like, who the fuck thinks of that shit? That guy is unfucking believable.
David Cross.
Yeah, David Cross. He's back to doing stand up now.
David Cross. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's funny.
I'll tell you, man. I mean, one of the greatest stand up specials I've ever seen, and it's in top five, and it surprises people when I say it. And I've never watched his show. Fucking Daniel Tosh.
Yeah, he's
great.
Oh, God.
It's incredible.
Dude, it was like people pleaser.
OG.
OG offense. You talk about a motherfucker bringing up everything and killing. His 9/11 bit.
Yeah, it's great.
You talk about smart. You talk about
the
jet ski, dude. Fucking dude is unbelievably funny. Like, I think he's almost Eminem-esque in terms of
But he disappeared from the stage. Once he got
yeah,
the show.
Well, he's in syndication now. He doesn't ever have to work again, man. Shit.
You know, but also, man, like, also, I did a show with him at the Improv, and he's a really, and I don't mean weird in a bad way. He's a really introverted guy.
Yeah.
Like, you can tell he's fundamentally uncomfortable with the crush, the fame, the people. Like, it's just not his bag, man. And there's certain people you meet, and, like, most of the comics you meet are just, that's who they are. You know, and it's not an act or whatever, but he's like, he was sort of, you know, and by the way, when he got up, he fucking destroyed. But, like, when people say there's nothing you can laugh at, I go back and listen to the 9/11 bit and how far he drills down on that bit to be sure that everyone is offended.
Yeah.
Right.
He actually tells a joke that his, like, the way he writes his jokes is he wants to start with something pretty ubiquitous that everybody understands.
He waits until he chisels the audience.
Dude, he does.
Even the last person's like, what the fuck
are
you
talking
about?
And I'm going to butcher it in fairness because this guy's literally like a maestro, but it's basically, and his opener, he's like, so is it too late to talk about the good that came from 9/11? And you hear the crowd just like, and he goes, like, how about we now know that September is 9? Like, that didn't used to be a thing. Like, and he goes through this whole bit and is literally, right? And this whole thing about the drop, having to drop off a bitch you fucked at the airport before 9/11. You had to walk up, and it was this whole thing, and now you can just kick him the fuck out. It's like, thanks, Bin Laden. Hope you're enjoying that. And he goes through this whole thing, and at the end he goes, and again, I'm skipping over everything. I'm butchering it. I'm not doing it justice. But then he goes, yeah, all I'm saying is that's worth, you know, that's worth a tower. Not two, not two. And then he goes, as everyone's finally booing him and turning on him, he goes, well, it doesn't matter which tower. Which tower? Does it matter? It did to my uncle. And you... And you hear the crowd, finally, the last efforts of booing, and he stops, he takes a drink, he goes, now everyone's offended, we can move on. And I was just like, God damn, that's good. Shit is great.
That's why I like Anthony Jeselnik.
Oh,
he's got this one quote.
Yes.
This one quote, and it pops up in a lot of his shows. He'll tell the most horrible joke you've ever heard in your life, and then he'll say, well, if you didn't know where you were, you sure as shit know now.
Yeah.
Right. It's just like that guy. I've never heard anyone go as far as him, I don't think. Successfully as a fucking blue-eyed white man.
Well, now that he's highlighted it, I think Tosh and Eddie Izzard both do that fucking audience chiseling.
Yeah.
Like, because you remember, like, Eddie's specials, it's always like, oh, six of you? All right, now we're on track.
Yeah. Like, just take it further and further until nobody knows what the fuck's going on anymore.
I love that aspect.
Yeah, same.
Like, it's like...
Have you ever seen Norm MacDonald live?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, oh man.
God. Yeah,
he does amazing. The same shit. He goes down these fucking crazy rabbit holes.
You're kind of like...
Yeah.
Where the fuck are you going, man? Like,
yeah.
Where are
I don't
you
know
going?
About
I saw him. I saw him in San Francisco, and he went hard after trannies, dude. Like,
what's the steal about
in
trannies?
San Francisco?
Yeah,
he went fucking hard after trannies.
This was like 2016, I think.
But that's the problem with that people understand, man. Like, one of the fundamentals of linguistics, and you probably know this, is that human communication is receiver based, which is incredibly inconvenient. It doesn't matter what I mean to say. Yeah. It means how you take it.
Right.
So, like, you'll hear people go, that was a rape bit. Like, I'll give an example. Like, Doug Stanhope did this great bit. There's a guy. I'm sorry. Doug Stanhope. You talk about our Sid Vicious, our punk rock.
Yeah.
Truly does not give a fuck. A lot of people say they don't give a fuck, but they still take that corporate money and suck that network dick. Doug Stanhope gives no fucks, dude. He did this bit when McCain was running. He goes, let me see if I got this right. You want to elect Sarah Palin president? She's got two retarded kids. One's got Down syndrome and the other joined the army. Now, that is not, if you knew anything about that joke and you think about it, that's got nothing to do with people who are mentally disabled. What he's saying is it's retarded that someone would join the military at a time when you're guaranteed to get your head blown off. Say what you want about it, either side. People are like, he was talking about retarded people. You're like, no, the fuck he wasn't. That joke had nothing to do with people who were special.
Right.
It was his thought, and that's even what he said. He goes, dude, if you want to rip me for being a lefty, that's fine, but it wasn't, you know.
Oh, no, I saw him in South Carolina one time, and he told his joke where it's bad.
I can't wait!
I can't say it. I can't repeat it on air. But he wanted to use an F word that describes people. He goes, if you bring me, I'll suck a giant black man's dick every day for the rest of my life if I could just use that word with impunity. Please let me. And everybody's just standing around like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And he didn't skip the word, by the way. He just was pounding
out. So, like, people who really know comedy, he still sells out everywhere. He might just be doing a 200 or 300 seater. But for the rest of his life, with no, because he's toxic to media, no Live Nation, nobody will touch him. But he's our fucking Sid Vicious, man. He's our punk rock, legit, true.
He's probably making more money because he's getting more of a cut because no fucking big.
He would have made a lot of money if he'd played ball, but he doesn't.
Yeah, man. If he would have taken Man Show on into something corporate, he would have.
Yeah, I mean, people don't remember, man, that George Carlin was squeaky clean. People don't remember that. Like, before Vietnam, George Carlin had sold out and was making $500,000 a year in Vegas. He wore a suit. He didn't have no beard. He was like, yeah, and this, and, and then, yeah, take my wife.
Did you see him on the, what's the show?
Hippy Dippy Weatherman.
Yeah, that too. But what was
he was that character.
What was the late night show back then?
Ed Sullivan.
Ed Sullivan, yeah.
Yeah, he was that dude.
Look at him on the Ed Sullivan show in 56 in that time frame, and he's just like a fucking nerd.
Yeah.
Like, giant nerd.
And getting paid out the ass.
Yeah, he
like $500,000 back in 62.
Right. Yeah, he was a comedian that was in his early 30s, already in residency in Vegas. Yep.
And threw it all away because he believed so much against, he was so firmly against the Vietnam War, and he got so tired of sucking that corporate dick, he just couldn't do it.
Yeah, but then he did 12 HBO specials, so I think he'd made out all right.
Yeah, but I don't consider doing an HBO special, somebody airing your hour, I don't consider that sucking a corporate dick.
At all, but he did ads for collect phone call stuff. Remember that? Because he addressed it in his set. And he goes, look, I know I talk a lot about corporate greed up here, and you may have seen me in some commercials recently. You're just going to have to figure that one out for yourself.
But it wasn't just who he embraced. It was the type of material he started doing.
He went wild, man.
He went wild. He got into, you saw that bit online of me doing the word fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
That's nothing new. That all goes back to Carlin. And originally, it goes back to who I think are the greatest. It goes back to Monty Python.
Because if you ever heard Monty Python on YouTube, they've got a bit about the uses of the word fuck.
Right? Yeah.
And then Bernie Mac did it.
It's almost like that song at the beginning of The Meaning of Life or whatever. It's kind of styled that way. It's super interesting.
Yeah.
But they were way... That was stuff that would play 10 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
But they were way ahead. They're, Monty
oh,
Python,
those guys are straight out of Compton. Oh, yeah, shit. I'm, there
I'm
is.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We're live in L.A.
The Walking Trans Am.
And I got...
camo shirt. No,
I got a little carried away, and I'm sorry. I
the camo hat, Ohio State fucking t-shirt, baggy jeans, and Nikes.
Are these baggy? Bless you.
For out here? Yes.
For out here, for sure.
Yeah, those are super loose for out here. What are you going to do? I don't remember what we were talking about before I got assaulted.
Hey, man, all I got to say is this is a good spot to wrap. We do. We got to wrap. These two guys just showed up. Where are we at, Dave?
Have we been doing this again?
Where are we at?
Get the fuck out with it. It happened again.
Yeah, yeah. It happened again. Happened again.
Dude, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, dude. Yeah.
Dude, I've done morning radio. And this, hey, man, this is a blast.
120 a pop.
There is no fucking this hammers, not been, man. This has not been.
Two fucking hammers.
Yeah, this Jesus is fucking great, Christ, dude. We got to have you on like all the fucking time, I think.
God damn, dude. I had a blast, dude.
Yeah, coming to San Antonio. We're doing
Can a third one happen?
We got to do a live show in San Antonio that it is, what,
fully
American Military USA. You. What do they call that? Veteran USA. What's San Antonio again?
Military
Town USA.
Military City, yeah.
Yeah, I did. I've actually done the is it the LOL?
Yep.
The,
yeah.
Right there on the Riverwalk. Yeah, I've done that. And when I was at Fort Hood, we used to go to San Antonio because of Lackland, all the girls there.
Yeah.
Because there weren't any women at Fort Hood in the infantry back then. There were no women. They weren't allowed.
Now there are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
pass.
John, thank you for being here tonight.
Dude, thank you guys so much, man. Thank you.
Fucking dude. Number two.
Number two. This is fucking great, man.
For Dan Holloway and for John Stites.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.